We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. More than 174 million Americans are gamers, and the average young person in the United States will spend 10,000 hours gaming by the age of 21. Now, numbers like that will no doubt have a lot of people shaking their heads and exclaiming, what a waste of time. But our guest for this hour of the show, Jane McGonigal, internationally known game designer and futurist, she argues that games fulfill some genuine human needs, and she makes an even bigger argument. She says that it's possible that play in the virtual can actually help us fix what is wrong with the real world. And that is one of the ideas that she explores in her book, Reality is Broken, a subtitle, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. It's published by Penguin Press, and it is recently out. Jane McGonigal is director of game research and development at the Institute for the Future, and her work has been featured in a lot of places, Economist, Wired, New York Times, CNN, NPR. In 2009, Business Week said she was one of the 10 most important innovators to watch. She does a lot of speaking on this subject, and we're pleased that she could spend some time with us here this morning to talk about it. Questions, comments are welcome. We do ask people to try to be brief and be on the topic, but other than that, your involvement in the conversation is certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free. 800-222-9455. You may also email comments, questions to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, if people want to jump in, they're welcome to do that. And Dr. McGonigal, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think you have a lot of really interesting things to say here. I expect, though, that when you talk about this, there is a kind of initial hurdle that you have to get over with people who right away, when you say things like you think possibly gaming and games can help the human species survive, that's a big pill right at the beginning for people to take. I watched the TED talk that you gave, and when you said something like that, people just laughed. Mm-hmm. And I figure if anybody, you know, if there'd be any place that you'd get a sympathetic hearing, it would be at TED. But even those folks, it sort of the idea just seemed like maybe almost a little bit too much.
Yeah, but only for a few minutes. You know, I had them by the end.
Well, you did, and actually, no, you absolutely did. And I think that says yes, initially, you'll say, "Wait a minute, what are you talking about?" But I think if you give the ideas a little bit of a chance to soak in, that it doesn't at the end it doesn't seem to be quite as outrageous a kind of a statement as it does at the beginning.
Exactly. You know, I think the misconception that we're really battling against is the idea that games are a waste of time. You know, I wanted to look into the research about what happens to our minds and our bodies and our relationships when we play. And it turns out there's more than a decade of scientific research that suggests that gaming is actually extraordinarily productive, that it produces positive emotions that not only, you know, change how we feel when we're playing the game, but actually trickle over into real life. So feelings like curiosity and optimism. And then also they change our relationships with people who we play with. There's tremendous research that shows that when we spend time playing games with friends and family, that we actually strengthen our relationships, we trust them more, we have more open communication, we're more likely to help them in real life. So that's sort of the first part of the puzzle, is unlocking what's really happening when we play games, particularly when we play games with people that we care about, and starting to see video games not as a waste of time, but actually helping us generate what we really crave out of real life.
Yeah, and I think it's worth making the point, as you do, for those people who might talk about playing games being a waste of time. I think one would have to say that making and playing games is something that human beings have been doing as far as we know, almost as long as we've been around, but certainly as long as there is recorded history. And some people have even gone as far as to argue that making and playing games, and not just play, but organized play, is one of the things that defines us as humans.
Exactly. You know, the first recorded history of gamer addiction was recorded by Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, thousands of years ago. He wrote about ancients who were addicted to dice games so much so that they forgot to eat. And then we just saw a study this month where they were reporting that 1 out of 10 artifacts dug up in an ancient region of what is now Pakistan, Mohenjo-Daro, 1 in 10 were game artifacts, and that they were all centered around centers of urban life, so that there were these huge gaming centers 4,000 years ago. So definitely organized gaming, it does seem to be an exceptionally powerful way to get people together to focus their attention on a challenge, and we've been doing it for as long as we've been human.
Yeah, I suppose that some people might be surprised to open up a book that's about gaming and about computers and about virtual reality and suddenly find themselves reading about Herodotus. But I think it's interesting and instructive that you mentioned this story that he tells, which at the time that he was writing it, he was claiming it had been a long time in the past, about a place where, about a country where there was this famine. There wasn't enough to eat. And
exactly.
That the government came up with this idea, well, let's find some way to distract people.
Exactly, right. And so, you know, Herodotus wrote that it was in ancient Lydia that they invented these dice games so that people would play games on one day. They would have everyone in the country play games on one day. And then on the next day, they would eat. And then the next day, they'd get so immersed in their games, they wouldn't realize how hungry they were. And Herodotus wrote that they actually passed 18 years this way, being able to sort of depend on each other, come to agreement about, you know, not wasting their resources. I mean, that's an intensely cooperative effort. You know, it's not just about distraction. It's about organizing the whole society around the common problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose, though, that one can, if you want to take that to the dark side, people will point to some of the stories that we have heard about, particularly about these very complex games now that people can play using their computers, and it may just be them in the game. There are also games that involve many players, people playing at the same time, and we read stories about addiction, and we see that there are people who would get so involved in the games that they don't want to do anything else. So that gets at this question. Another one of these questions that you look at is, well, what is it about these games that can have such a powerful hold on people?
Right, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, was thinking about where is that tipping point when we're not playing games in a way that's productive, but when we're playing games in a way that's escapist. And it turns out that the number of hours per week that starts to lead towards downward spirals or social phobia, depression, and addiction is about 28 to 30 hours a week. So there's actually scientific research now that we can point to show, you know, where you can look at your own game time or you can look at your kids' game time and see, is this starting to tip over into what people might call addicting or pathological? And so that's important. And then if you are spending that much time playing a game, to really question, what is it about the game that is provoking my emotions and making me feel more social than real life? And are there ways for us to create that phenomena in real life? And that's why the book is called Reality is Broken, because if this many people are so drawn to virtual worlds, it would sort of behoove us to look at what that is and bring it back into real life.
Yeah, I think it's a really deliberate effort to get at this question. Why is it that so many people find the virtual worlds in which they play to be so much more attractive, so much more better, a better place, the place that they would rather be? Why is it that's better than real life?
Yeah, it looks like the foundation for everything we get out of games is something called eustress or positive stress. And that is what happens when we choose a goal that we want to tackle, and then we marshal all of our personal strengths and resources to tackle it. It's actually very similar to negative stress, in the sense that we have the same physiological reactions. We get more adrenaline, our heart rate goes up, our breathing quickens, we sharpen the attention centers of the brain. But when we are under negative stress, we experience all of these reactions as anxiety, or we feel resentment or frustration. And this is the kind of feeling we might get at the workplace or at school when we just don't feel in control of the challenges that we're tackling. But if we choose our obstacles, then we experience all of these reactions as motivation and drive and excitement and enthusiasm. And it's actually an incredibly positive state to be in. It turns out it's a sort of an optimal human state of being, that when we're under positive stress, we perform better, we set more ambitious goals, we're more likely to ask others for help, and they're more likely to give it to us because we're more likable when we're under a state of positive stress. We're more optimistic and we're more energized. So, when we see people playing games for 30 or 40 hours a week, it's not that they're lazy or they're, just sort of being passive escapists. They're actually activating their positive stress. They're going into that optimal state of human being that they're having a hard time finding at work or at school or in their ordinary lives.
Yeah, and I think this gets, at an important point and maybe for some people counterintuitive, that people who think, well, the reason other folks play games is to relax somehow. And the fact of the matter is that this sort of ideal state is not relaxing. It can be stressful. And yet, as you say, there's a difference between that kind of what's happening there and the kind of stress maybe you might ordinarily encounter on your job or in school.
Exactly. Yeah, and I should say we do often feel relaxed after we play a game, but the important transition, it's not we go straight from boredom or anxiety to being relaxed. We have to go through this challenging phase. We go through this positive stress and activating that motivation and drive and wrestling with hard work is what brings us to a state where we then feel free of the anxiety or feel free of the frustration.
Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, Jane McGonigal. She's Director of Game Research and Development at the Institute for the Future and is well known as a futurist and game designer. She is the author of the book Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. It's published by Penguin Press. Out now. Also, she has a website, janemcgonigal.com, so if you're interested in finding out more about her, you can see some of the interviews that she's done. You can read some of the things that she has written and get another sense also of her ideas. You can do that. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here to bring in the conversation, so I kind of think I will go ahead and do that and talk to them on our toll-free line here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm up front to look at it basically escapism because I've got two boys in the family. That's all they do. They won't get jobs, don't do anything except sit around and play games. And if you ask them to do things that you're talking about, they don't seem to be getting what you say they're supposed to be getting. So I'm wondering where this all fits into, say, Las Vegas, New Jersey, for example. There's a lot of gaming there. Pinochle, dice game, dominoes, all that. Can you put it all together, or are you just particularly saying it has to be digital games and virtual reality? I'd like to know about some of them early assumptions you've made along the way. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. Well, there are maybe a few questions there. I can just sort of jump around and tackle them as I heard them.
Sure.
First of all, it's definitely not just digital and computer games. So it doesn't have to have a digital component. In the book, I do talk about games that we play in real life, sort of more sports-like games. I talk about card games and even board games. And basically, it's more about this unnecessary obstacle that the game poses. It's not an interactive technology. It's a game provides a challenge and gives us rules for how we can try to accomplish that challenge and focuses our attention on that goal. So it doesn't have to be a digital game, although digital games do have special qualities like the networking that lets us play with people all over the world, or cooperative gaming where we can tackle a goal with our friends and family instead of competing against each other. So there are sort of special qualities to video games that do tend to provoke more positive emotions and stronger relationships. in terms of Las Vegas, you know, we do see that it's very important for gaming for there not to be stakes on the line, so that you're playing them for the actual pleasure of playing the game and not for extrinsic rewards, like making money. As soon as you put some actual stakes on a game, then it does change the positive stress to potentially negative stress. So it becomes a different kind of thing. So that's important to keep in mind. And then in terms of, you know, the challenge of having children, kids, grown kids, who seem to be stuck in the game world. You know, this is something I really wanted to write about and that I do talk to gamers about a lot, is the idea of switching that feeling of escapism to looking at games as a springboard for real life. You know, I write about in the book the real world strengths that you develop by playing a game, including resilience in the face of failure, you know, the ability to learn from your mistakes. And we are trying to talk to gamers about taking this into real life. What does it mean to take those skills and apply them to real-world challenges? And there are examples in the book of doing that, including a game that I created which teaches you how to start your own business, 10 weeks to develop your own business plan. That game's called Evoke, and that's online, and you can play it. So it is a problem that we are facing, looking at many gamers who are sort of opting out. And this book and the games that I make are trying to create a bridge between who we feel like we can be in games and who we can be in real life.
Yeah, I have another caller here we'll get to, and something definitely in our conversation I want to get to also and have you talk some more about some of the games that you have created, these things that maybe sometimes are called quote-unquote real-world games. But I think here you point to a real problem and a real challenge, and something that I know that you've talked about and you write about, that is... there are a lot of gamers, people who play games, that feel that while they might be really good at games and have accomplished a lot within the world of the games, that they're actually not very good at life, and especially when they're confronted by real obstacles and have to deal with real failure. So the question is, can you somehow, maybe that's about structuring in some way the challenges of real life, to provide some of the same kind of structures and rewards as the game. Now, I don't know that really means that you can make the real world like World of Warcraft, but that somehow there's this question of, well, how do you take the challenge and reward systems that you find in games and bring them over to the real world?
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy, I think, to make the real world like World of Warcraft. Super Mario would be harder, but we can talk about why that is.
Well, talk some more about that and about what you do for people who say, yeah, I can deal with games, but life I can't deal with.
Yeah. So the important thing to know is that there are people in every industry you can imagine right now who are trying to take insights from games to change the way real life works. There are people working in healthcare and medicine, people working in school and education, people working in the travel industry, I mean, anything you could think of. And maybe just a quick example would help show you what kind of transformation might be possible. One of my favorite groups, it's a charter school in New York City called Quest to Learn, and they're trying to reform curriculum for middle school students inspired by game design. Now, this doesn't mean that the kids spend all day playing games, quite the opposite. They have, you know, typical classroom education, hands-on, labs, books, that kind of thing. But they've structured the way you learn to be more like a game. One of the things that they looked at was failure in schools. Failure in schools is very punishing. You know, you don't get to decide when you take a test. Somebody else decides, and it doesn't matter if you just needed 3 more days to really understand the material, and maybe you could have gotten an A instead of a C. You know, it doesn't matter if you were having a bad day. If you didn't feel up to performing that day, it's a permanent part of your record. You take the test, whatever you do, that's it for life. And we're very punishing of people not getting a second chance with learning. Where in game worlds, you can take a quest as many times as you like. You keep tackling the quest until you're happy with your performance. So the school has decided that maybe we don't need as a society to punish our kids when they try to learn, that we can actually allow them to take tests as many times as they need to conquer the material until they're happy with their grade, just like we do in game worlds, in games like World of Warcraft. Now, what's really interesting is that after they started implementing this in the school, scientific research has come out showing that we learn better by taking tests than we do by studying, because when we're taking the test, we're actually seeing where the gaps are in our knowledge. We're really putting our skills to the test, and we actually understand better what we know and what we don't know. So not only is it inspired by games, we can actually see scientific research now showing that, yes, the way we've set up learning and failure in games is preferable to real life. A lot of times I hear people say, you know, well, there are no consequences in games, so when you fail, it doesn't matter. Real life isn't like that. But we can actually start to look at the real world and say, are there things in real life where there are only consequences to failure because we've made it that way, where we can redesign what we're doing so that it can be more like a game?
Well, I'm sure, though, in addition to people saying that in real life there are consequences, they'd also say, well, the problem with real life is that you can't pick your challenges. They come, and they may not be of your choice. They may not come when you feel like you're ready. So real life can't really be, you can't have the level of control in real life that you can in the game.
Right, but that's, game design can help also with that challenge. I worked on a game called World Without Oil, where our goal was to get people to change their real world habits when it came to energy use and oil consumption. And this is actually a challenge we all face as a planet, whether we think about it every day or not. We're already facing it, trying to figure out how we can reduce our dependence on oil. And we created a game where we turned it into a voluntary obstacle, into a self-motivated challenge. We created a 6-week simulation of an oil shortage, and we just asked people, do you think you could survive if we had a scenario where the oil prices doubled? How would you survive? How would you get to work? How would your kids get to school? How would you get food? What would you cook? And we asked people to live 6 weeks of their life as if this were really happening. And they documented it with videos and blog posts and photos, and you can see all of this real-life simulation happening online in the game world if you visit today. And what was really fascinating is people who would never sort of take seriously trying to change their habits for real reasons were perfectly happy and very motivated to adopt this unnecessary challenge, this, I want to see if I could survive, I'm ready to make these changes. It's not a simple thing to take real challenges and make them feel like we're self-motivated and we're feeling positive stress, but we can do it. Mm.
And there, just to one more quick point, and then I'll get on to the caller, to make that example more important, more interesting, you did in fact find that people who had played the game that of thinking about how they might change their life if the price of oil doubled, that you found out that then some of those people, at least those ideas they came up, those strategies they came up as a result of the game, they actually then did those things. So that led, in some people's cases, it led to a change in the way they lived.
Oh, yeah. The vast majority of players actually made changes in their real lives. We actually tracked the players for quite a while after the game on a blog called World Without Oil Live. So you can actually see sort of follow-ups on what people were doing on that blog. The fascinating thing was a year after we finished the game, we actually had gas prices in the United States reach the prices that we were simulating in the game. We were able to follow up with players and find out that, yes, they actually had skills in place. They had plans in place. They were able not only to be more empowered themselves, but to help friends and neighbors. So, you know, that was a game with the motto, play it before you live it, and it actually did seem to prepare people for that future.
All right. Well, let's talk with another caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Years ago, there was a researcher by the name of Brian Sutton Smith, and this was pre-computer, he analyzed games and came out with categories of knowledge, skill, and chance, and decided that games of chance, while being very addictive, were not particularly useful or not particularly good for people in respect to life skills. Knowledge games that emphasized knowledge and skills were much more beneficial. Have you used some sort of analysis of the nature of the game, similar to Brian Sutton Smith? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Great. Well, you know, Brian Sutton Smith is one of my favorite researchers. In fact, he's the researcher who said that the opposite of play isn't work, it's depression, which is one of the big ideas that's really driven my research, the idea that play is the opposite of depression, that we're energized and optimistic and wholeheartedly engaged with whatever we're doing when we're playing a game. So I'm a big fan of his work. And to the point that chance games are not as sort of productive as skill-based games or learning games, absolutely, we see in computer and video games that chance plays a very small to a non-existent role in popular games today. In fact, if you go to the Game Developers Conference every year, you will hear people talk about how much gamers don't like chance within their game world, because what gamers are actually trying to do is they're trying to learn how to be good in the system. They're trying to master the game. And the more chance that there is in the game, the less sort of control and mastery that players are able to develop. So this is something that the industry has really paid attention to and done a pretty good job of reflecting in the game design. And I think it also shows that, you know, what video gamers are getting out of their games really is that experience of getting good at something, getting mastery, trying hard, and improving, and not, I don't know, what we might think of as sort of simpler, addicting pleasures of just trying to win. You know, it actually turns out that gamers spend about 80% of their time in game worlds failing because the games are so challenging that they do have to try again and again and again to reach their goal. And so, you know, that it's not about that quick win. It's about mastery and improvement. Hmm.
Well, I'm sure there is some, and perhaps this also brings us back to the question of gambling and why people do it. As I think back to my days as a psychology undergraduate, one of the things that I remember is that one of the best ways to reinforce a behavior is to have the reward schedule be completely unpredictable. So that you have to keep doing something, and occasionally you'll get a reward, but you never know when the reward will come. And that's really what, you know, that's like your definition of a slot machine. You just keep pulling that handle. Maybe some point you're going to hit, but you don't know when. And I think there's probably a big difference in the nature of the reward or the reward structure between something like that, where it almost doesn't really have anything to do with you. I mean, yes, you have to take this action, but you really never know when it's going to pay off. And something that's more directed, where at least you have the expectation that if you try hard, you master the conditions of the game, then eventually, maybe not right away, but eventually you're going to win. It seems that it has much more to do with you.
Mm-hmm. And I should say, you know, that game designers do use the intermittent reward schedule as part of game design, but it's always wrapped within some kind of a challenge or some kind of a work goal that you have to accomplish. So, you know, in World of Warcraft, when you complete a quest, you might get some special loot, and that is sort of on an intermittent reward schedule. Or when you're in Farmville and you're harvesting your crops, you might find, you know, a special, you know, a can of fuel in your fields, and that's intermittent reward. So those elements are in the games because game designers are looking to sort of keep people engaged longer and longer terms. And it is, I should say, it's a little bit controversial because it does drive gameplay that's not purely motivated by these sort of positive stress conditions that seem to be at the center of a lot of gameplay. And it's controversial. So it is worth sort of looking at that. And a lot of game designers won't use that system because they feel that it would just addict players and doesn't provide any real productive benefit.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Jane McGonigal. She's Director of Game Research and Development at the Institute for the Future. Her work has been featured in The Economist, in Wired, New York Times, NPR, MTV, CNN. Business Week called her one of the 10 most important innovators to watch, and she is the author of a recently published book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. And what she does in the book is take a look at games and why it is people play them, what's the nature of the satisfaction that people derive, and ask this question, well, is it possible that you can use that and use that to that knowledge to construct games that allow people to work on real-world problems and develop solutions to real-world problems? And she says, yeah, you actually can do that, and she has done that. The Penguin Press is the publisher. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I really should ask you here, because I am certain that some people listening to this conversation or knowing about what you do would think, well, this is obviously the coolest job ever, to be a game designer. How it is that you got into this?
Yeah, I got into it because I was a gamer. and I was playing an online game in the year 2001 that was very collaborative. It required a lot of collective intelligence. All the players were creating wikis and discussion forums to pool their ideas and try strategies together. And a couple months after that game ended, 9/11 happened, and many of the gamers from that game showed back up in the discussion forums wondering if they could use the collective intelligence skills that they developed playing this online game to be of assistance. Could they help investigate? Could they help find missing people? Could they somehow, motivate people to donate or donate blood? And they were convinced that the skills we had all developed playing this game, the collaboration, superpowers, that we could use them to solve a real-world problem, that when some, real crisis happened, that we could help. And it was a very controversial idea. Many of the players in the group felt that, it was just a game, we don't have any real skills or abilities, but many other players said, well, we do, and we should use them for real-world good. This went back and forth for quite a while. They did set up relief efforts online, and I was so sort of amazed by this process that I thought, are there ways we could build games that do provide a bridge between game superpowers and real-life problems? And are gamers really developing skills and abilities that they could use for real good? So I wound up doing my dissertation on that, and I wound up partnering with the original creators of that game to make more games that would help build up these superpowers.
We have another caller. Let's talk with him. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I was wondering, speaking in terms of mastery of the game and that kind of thing, for more complex games, there's always, you can buy like 100-page strategy guides that tell you step-by-step how to go through the game and find every single secret and eventually win the game. But in a way, it's also kind of like cheating because it's telling you all of the things that are supposed to be hidden within the game. I was just wondering what she thought about that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of debate and discussion in the gamer community about the extent to which you can use strategy guides, or a lot of players prefer videos online of walkthroughs where you can actually see another player completing the mission, exactly how it's done. There's debate as to whether this is sort of ruining the game experience or not. What we tend to see with people who play games in this way is that they don't play the game with the strategy guide or the walkthrough on their first pass of the game, or it's not something they use for their entire experience of the game, that they do come back to it for a second play, and they want to get to see every bit of the game. They want to see all the secrets and explore the entire system, or that maybe they've been playing for 20 hours and they're stuck, and they want to keep going, and they want to learn the right way to do it. So they look to other gamers to teach them how to do it through these strategy guides or through these walkthrough videos online. And I admit, I use them too. When I'm playing a game and I get stuck and I want to know a solution, and I've tried and I've banged my head for hours, I do use them sometimes. And I think it's a question of, are we actually then learning to play the game? Are we learning the system? And that's another kind of gamer experience that we're also seeing challenge our way of teaching in regular schools. You know, we were talking about the quest to learn school earlier. You know, is it cheating to have other people who know how to do something well show us how to do it? Or does it help us learn it ourselves and become maybe possible mentors ourselves? So, you know, we do see a lot of people eventually go on to become mentors for other players. They learn how to do it online, but then they teach their sister how to do it, or they teach their parents how to do it. So, you know, it's sort of about opening up our minds as what a learning community can be and how we can learn, and do we all have to learn it ourselves, or can we teach each other?
Well, I suppose that actually is the definition of teaching and learning, really. You know, is you have someone who has mastered some skill, helping somebody else master that skill and showing them the path to do it. One, I suppose, though, depending on what it is you're talking about, the person, the learner, still has to do the work, even though you have somebody coaching you.
Exactly. Yeah, and some people are more attracted to the thrill of figuring out them for themselves, and others are just want to learn how to do it. So depending on the gamer, they'll either bang their head against the wall for, you know, 40 hours till they get it, or they'll ask somebody to teach them.
And it's really stunning how much around some of these games, and I suppose the granddaddy is World of Warcraft, of these kinds of massive multiplayer online games, those kind of games, an amazing amount of information, lore, study, writing, analysis, how-to has been built up around these games, and that game in particular.
Yeah, there are actually two major wikis for World of Warcraft, each with just under 90,000 articles, which make them among the largest wikis in the world. And, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of research, 90,000 articles detailing every possible land you can visit, every character you could encounter, every strength that you could level up, and how you would apply it with each of the quests in each of the lands. And when you think about it, you know, if gamers were just about sort of escaping and having fun, you know, why would they be creating these huge resources that millions of people use every month? They're actually becoming a part of this bigger effort to document their experience, to provide resources to other players to learn faster and do better in the world. These wikis often have mission statements that they want to raise up every player's skill so that the entire gaming community becomes better for everybody's benefit. And it really is bigger than just, you know, one person playing their own game.
Mm-hmm. I guess that also brings me back to the reward here. And I suppose that there are some people who actually manage to make a living playing games. But by definition, the idea is the game is something that you play because there is no concrete reward. I guess that's the difference between a game and a job. Yeah, something that you do because it pays money. That's the job. The game, you don't do it for that. So then that gets back to this big question about, well, why people do it. And the idea that even if it's virtual, the idea of being involved in this enormous project, whatever the goal is, that involves all these people working together one way or another toward the same goal, and achieving benchmarks and accumulating experience and moving up some kind of a ladder. All of those things together are huge as far as the human psyche is concerned, hugely satisfying. And that gets back to the question, well, why do people do it?
Indeed, yeah. If you look at years of positive psychology research into what makes a meaningful life, what makes a satisfying life, it boils down to four things. One is satisfying work, something we can do that we see our impact on the world around us. We crave the hope of success, the sort of the experience of getting better at something and feeling like we may one day be successful. We crave time with people that we like and care about to sort of build our social relationships. And we also like to be a part of something bigger than ourselves, to be of service to a heroic mission or to develop a sense of purpose, you know, a community, a cooperative goal, extreme scale collaboration. And all four of these things are really at the heart of computer and video game play today, the chance to be blissfully productive in a virtual environment. So we really feel like it's satisfying work, this getting better at the game worlds of learning and improving so that we feel like we have a real chance of success.
Mm.
And then, of course, the fact that the majority of gameplay today is actually social gameplay, that we're spending time we're spending with real-life friends and family. The sort of myth of playing with strangers on the Internet is no longer the primary way that we play games. We actually spend most of our time playing games with people we know in real life. And then these big, cooperative, massively multiplayer projects, they do help us tap into a larger community and to put our effort into cooperative goals, even if those goals might not feel as purposeful as, say, curing cancer or ending hunger. The fact that we are with millions of other people working on a project together, it does start to fulfill our need to have meaningful role in society.
Well, here is where we get at the nub of it, because I think that to get back to the idea of reality being broken or reality being unsatisfying. And if you look at those things you've enumerated as things about games people find satisfying, what's terrifically sad probably about a lot of people's lives is that, well, maybe one of these things, that is having some kind of social network, one hopes you have a family, you have friends, you have people that you're involved with. But I'm sure that a lot of people would say that the place where the hole is in their life is the satisfying and important work, you know, the sense that they have challenges to meet that they can meet that pushes them to the limits of their ability, but they're actually things that if they work at them, they actually can achieve, and that they're things that mean something. I'd say probably you're a pretty lucky person if in your life you have things like that, but most people don't. But what the argument seems to be that you're making is that actually this is a way, by having these sort of positive, constructive world kind of games, is actually a way for people who otherwise in their life wouldn't have that kind of reward to actually experience that.
Right. And, I mean, this is a big thing that's happening in games now, is that people are trying to make games that have real work embedded inside of them so that it's not just escapist satisfying work, but that you're actually contributing to a major planetary scale challenge. Some of my favorite games from the past year tried to give gamers an opportunity to participate in real scientific research that could one day cure cancer or cure Alzheimer's. There are two games you can play now. One is called Fold It, all one word, Fold It. The other is called Eterna, like eternal without the L. And both of these games give you virtual environments where you can work on folding proteins or designing molecules like RNA, and you can use your creativity to learn how to fold proteins or design RNA in different ways that could actually help scientists come up with new medicines to treat these diseases. And so far, more than 57,000 gamers have contributed such creative ideas, such strong scientific ideas, even without any previous experience in the scientific area, that the people who created the game, scientists at University of Washington, were able to publish an article in Nature Journal, so the most prestigious scientific journal, about using this game to cure cancer, potentially, and they listed 57,000 gamers as co-authors on the scientific paper. So here are people who would not ordinarily be participating in scientific research who have now become co-authors of a paper in the most prestigious scientific journal in the world. So we do see that these games are being made, games that can connect you and your gamer skills to real-world problems.
Hmm. Well, does this tap in at all? Are you interested in this notion that says that we may be approaching a point, or maybe even there in some small way, where what we're doing with computers and the Internet is taking all of these disparate individuals, could be living all various places all around the world, them, their brains, their ideas, and linking them together, and in the process, creating something bigger?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm really a big fan of the research into collective intelligence and also social contagion. You know, we know that people are more connected than ever before, and that ideas move faster, that habits move faster, that knowledge moves faster. And so there are there does seem to be this opportunity with massively multiplayer games to become a conduit for data and knowledge and habits and change to spread quickly. Games are a really good platform for this because they are global. We know that people all over the world play, and that games can connect us to solve these problems. So, yes, we think that's happening, and it's very exciting.
We have about 5 minutes left in this hour of Focus with Jane McGonigal. Her book is Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. We have a caller here. We will get certainly this one. If somebody else wants to call real quick, we can try to get him in. This is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I don't consider myself a gamer, but I do play things once in a while. But when we got our first computer, our first IBM PC years ago when our kids were little, about the only thing that we could find that seemed educational and fun was Flight Simulator, which was developed here. And at that point, the computer couldn't handle much in the way of graphics. So what you saw on the screen was grid lines and occasional buildings. And when I tried it out, I picked one of the New York airports as my place I was taking off from. And guess what I ran into, because I was so much of a klutz, I ran into the World Trade Center, the towers. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what if somebody ever did that? No, that couldn't happen. But it wasn't my job to think about that. And I'm thinking, since the World Trade Center, and since I heard Condoleezza Rice standing up there and saying, who would have ever thought anybody would have run into the World Trade Center with airplanes? I thought to myself, well, if she'd paid attention to gamers, she might have thought about that. We could have prevented 9/11 with a little more imagination, and that's my thought for today. Thanks.
No, all right. I don't know. Jane, have you have any thought about that?
Well, I do work with the Institute for the Future, which is a nonprofit future forecasting organization where we try to help organizations and government plan, 10 years out in the future, 25 years out in the future. And we have created these massively multiplayer forecasting games at the Institute in order to do exactly that, to tap into the future imagination of ordinary people who might see something that maybe someone in a position of authority wouldn't see, and to communicate that. So there's one game that you can still look at and see all of the forecasts that were created by ordinary people. It was called Superstruct. Is in the book as well, and we had 8,000 people from all over the world, more than 100 countries, in fact, make forecasts over the next 10 to 20 years, areas about what will happen if there's a food shortage, what will happen if there's climate change, and we're able to really surprise professionals with what they were able to imagine. So that is something that we're looking at, massively multiplayer forecasting games to help tap into collective imagination about what might really happen.
Yeah, we're down to a couple of minutes here, but I would like to have you talk a little bit about another game that you were involved in developing. So you talked about World Without Oil and Superstruct. Tell us about Evoke.
Yeah, Evoke we did with the World Bank Institute. It was designed as a 10-week crash course in changing the world. We were reaching out primarily to young people in sub-Saharan Africa, but we actually wound up with players from more than 130 countries. And by playing this game, you learn about your own skills and abilities that could help you start a social enterprise or a company that not just makes money but also tackles a social problem like clean water or clean energy. And we enrolled just under 20,000 students in this course. And in teams, they created more than 50 real businesses that are actually now being funded. They've been matched with mentors. And they're tackling social issues on almost every continent. And we've just reopened this game online for groups, classes, anywhere to play the game again, to go through the 10-week crash course. So that's Evoke, and people can find it and help imagine their own business and possibly make it a reality.
Hmm. Just as a way of finishing up, if I had said this in the beginning, that maybe it would have been a hard thing for people to accept, but now at the end, having heard what you had to say and heard some examples, you have seriously, I think quite seriously, said that someday you hope to see a game designer win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, well, world peace requires a global effort and global participation. And I do think games are our most promising platform to engage the whole world in a single effort. And I do hope that by provoking positive emotions and teaching cooperation, collective intelligence, that we will see game designers who are solving real-world problems and mobilizing the hundreds of millions of gamers we have around the world to really make a tremendous impact on our future.
And for those people who also might say, maybe gamers who might say that this real-world games, this kind of thing, is it takes all the fun out of it, I'm sure that you would say, well, it's okay with you if there are still some games that provide the kinds of satisfactions that we're talking about, the reason that people play them, but that they're not games to save the world. They're just games that people are going to play because they say, well, they're fun.
Exactly. I mean, my recommendation to gamers is to spend 1 hour a week playing one of these more serious world-changing games, and the rest of your time just power up those skills and abilities in the games that we think of as entertainment. So we still need those fun, positive stress game environments to build up these powers. But then an hour a week of a serious game can really help us change the world.
Well, and if you consider how many people there are who are regular gamers, and then if they did that, that would be, if you added all those hours up, it would be a pretty stunning amount of time.
Right. It would be 500 million hours a week. And just to put that in quick perspective, researchers proposed that it had taken only 100 million hours of online collaboration to create all of Wikipedia, not just the system, but every single article. So that's 5 Wikipedias a week if every gamer spent an hour a week contributing to an online real-world problem-solving effort.
If folks would like to read some more about these ideas, the book to look for is Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. It's published by Penguin Press by our guest, Dr. Jane McGonigal. She's Director of Game Research and Development at the Institute for the Future. You can also look at her website, which is janemcgonigal.com. And thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.